People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. It's been called a hidden epidemic and the invisible injury. There are estimates that more than 50% of people experiencing homelessness have also experienced it. It can be a cause and an effect of homelessness, substance use, and addiction. It can be caused by a fall, a car accident, a sports injury, intimate partner violence, an overdose. It is brain injury. Today, on the first of a two-part look at the issue, we'll hear about its links to the toxic drug crisis. We'll also get some perspective on navigating life after a brain injury in the family. We're going to begin by hearing from a lead researcher with the BC Consensus on Brain Injury Project.
My name is Mauricio Garcia Barrera. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Victoria. I'm also the Associate Dean Research and Grad Studies in the Faculty of Social Sciences and a clinical neuropsychologist.
And I'm hoping to talk with you today about some of the links, perhaps, between the toxic drug crisis and brain injury. Could you tell me how many people this could be impacting?
This is something that we're starting to just beginning to estimate. So there is no an accurate number that I can just give you, but I can give you some of the estimates we're working with. So these estimates are derived from the coroner's report that we have at hand about how many people do not survive a brain injury or associated with the drug poisoning, so overdose. We have those counts for Canada, for BC, and with those, we can estimate approximately how many non-fatal injuries we're talking about. So to give you a sense, if we talk about, let's say, for the province of British Columbia, in 2023, we have records of 2,551 cases of fatal drug poisoning events, mostly associated with synthetic opioids like fentanyl. When we do a little bit of the math, using ratios that are estimated from studies in the states, these ratios state that for every case of a fatal accident with drug poisoning, there is about 15 cases of non-fatal. So we do a quick math, and I think that it adds up to like upwards of 38,000 potential cases of drug poisoning with brain injury associated with it in BC just in 1 year. When we look at the stats across Canada, we really are multiplying big numbers. So our estimates is that there are upwards of 600,000 possible cases of brain injury associated with drug poisoning in Canada since this toxic crisis was declared in 2016. Not every one of those cases is one single individual, because oftentimes what we see is these repeated overdoses. So they could be accounting for the same individual, some of those numbers, but it's quite a heavy number.
Could you explain to me exactly what we mean when we say there's an overdose and there could be a brain injury related to that? What does that look like, and what's the kind of severity and the degree of certainty we're talking about?
Absolutely. By definition, any time that a person loses consciousness because they're not breathing, we are talking about a hypoxic event that is a brain injury. But I will walk you a little bit through how that works. So in the case of toxic drug poisoning, like fentanyl overdose, what we see is that these drugs are going to be acting on the brain stem. The brain stem is at the very base of the brain. And within it, there are these nuclei, these systems of neurons that regulate our breathing function. It tells the body, the lungs and all the systems to breathe, to take oxygen in and out and all of this process. The effect of these drugs is a reduction of that breathing function. So, you know, in some instances, that may look like relaxation, but past certain thresholds, then you're having a respiratory depression. And the outcome of that is that there is going to be less oxygen going to the brain. And neurons, that are the basic cells in the brain, are absolutely in need of oxygen to survive, to do what they do, their work, but also to survive. So we have constant oxygen input to the brain. But in these cases with the respiratory depression, there's not enough oxygen. So that's what we call a hypoxic event, or no oxygen at all. And that's an anoxic event. And with those, we can guarantee that there are going to be cells being damaged. And depending on the duration of the lack of oxygen, now we have cell death. And then depending on how long that is, and the amount of cells that are being affected, then we have a brain injury that could be diagnosed and with long-term repercussions in many cases. That's usually like a way to explain the link between those two.
Now, obviously, it will depend on the severity of the injury, but can you explain what happens after someone has a brain injury like this? What are the consequences for them moving forward in their day-to-day life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're raising a good point. There is, of course, resiliency. Sometimes it's an invisible injury. We don't see immediately the effects. But oftentimes, especially if the person is vulnerable, what we see is all the symptoms associated with any brain injury. So there are neurological symptoms like constant headaches, dizziness, fatigue is the number one reported symptom. People feeling really tired. There is also sometimes weakness in the muscles. A little bit of tremors can be observed in some cases. There are also going to be behavioral changes. So personality changes, mood, people feeling really easily overwhelmed, easily stressed, experiencing mood changes, rapid mood changes from like feeling very anxious to feeling depressed. Suicide risk goes up. Also, they're going to have a lot of cognitive changes that more basically are associated with problems with attention, processing information, memory is number one being affected. And there's a whole group of cognitive functions that we call executive functions in our field. There are the cognitive processes that allows us to make decisions, problem solve, have a goal in mind and go for it, have judgment calls, discern what is good or bad for us. All of those are associated with executive process. So it translates into everyday life activity being affected, from employment, from keeping up your job, tasks in your job, from also keeping healthy relationships, communication in your relationships, sustaining your family, and so forth, depending on the severity. So it's a very complicated picture. Sometimes we don't see all of that group of symptoms at once. It depends, as you pointed out, on the severity, the extension of the damage, how acute was the servicing of this person after the overdose event. Like if they were able to intervene right away, that usually prevents further injury, and then the symptoms are going to be less present.
You're listening to People First Radio. We're focusing on brain injury on today's program. I'm speaking with Mauricio Garcia Barrera, a neuropsychologist and associate professor at the University of Victoria. Throughout the show, we'll also be hearing from Adele Rogers. She's worked as a volunteer coordinator with the Nanaimo Brain Injury Society, and she's going to share insights based on the lived experience of brain injury in her family.
14 years ago, my son, who is 19 at the time, was in a car crash, and it resulted in a severe brain injury. And it was devastating, of course, for my son, but it was also devastating for the family. And at that time, and still now, when it comes to traumatic brain injury, there's little prognosis in terms of recovery and abilities as they are going through their recovery. So it can be a very scary and challenging place, not just for the individual, but the family members, because it basically, Joe, changes the trajectory for everyone at that point. And in our case in particular, because he was 19. So we had 6 months in the hospital and continued rehabilitation after that. So we became quite intimate with the various services that were provided, both in the hospital from the acute phase to the rehabilitation. And then, of course, the transition into the you know, going back home, living in the community, trying to navigate life for my son and our family in a very different way.
We're going to hear more from Adele Rogers later on in the program. For now, I'm going to get you back to my conversation with Mauricio Garcia Barrera of the University of Victoria about the links between the toxic drug crisis and brain injury. Earlier on in our conversation, you mentioned that estimates you could extrapolate from other studies that there are maybe hundreds of thousands of overdoses that could be leading to brain injuries happening in Canada in most recent years. What are the consequences of that on maybe just our society more generally?
The number one thing that comes to mind always is the cost. And this cost is not just the monetary financial burden to the nation that amounts to the billions a year. When we compound all together the expenses on the ERs, the follow-up medical services and hospitalizations, the lack of employment and unemployment rates that go after that, issues with the criminal justice system, because a lot of them end up going into that system, homelessness issues. So all compound is very costly. But beyond the numbers and the finances of that, there's also a lot of cost in relation to trauma, you know, the trauma that is experienced by the individual, the loss, the grief that it follows, the sense of one changing, losing the identity of what they were before, what they were able to do before, and their families, you know, everyone around, anyone that survives a brain injury associated with drug poisoning is going to be impacted, particularly if it's severe, if there's a lot of symptoms present. So for society, it's very costly. It's changing a little bit the culture. There's a lot of stigma still associated with brain injury, particularly with these kinds of brain injury that are associated with addictions, with substance use, with overdoses, because we don't understand exactly all the factors that take a person to consume substances to the point of experiencing these events. There's a lot of judgment. You know, even in saying those words, one is like having to be very careful around how to approach this for the public, because there is a lot of lack of awareness out there. And people are using drugs that are heavily contaminated, that are very unregulated, and are very risky for their health. So it's a combination of factors for society. I think that is costly is like the word in all senses. A recent study from Stats Canada showed that a third of Canadians lived with experiences of trauma, of all kinds of trauma. And a significant portion of those are associated with traumatic brain injury. So when we take that picture of traumatic brain injury, that is slightly different than when we talk about hypoxia, anoxia, it's more acquired brain injury. Then we really escalate, like if there, of Canadians are experiencing trauma, imagine how many of them are experiencing trauma associated with drug poisoning and so forth, and the aftermath of that. So it's quite costly at many levels.
So this is Brain Injury Awareness Month. I guess what we're doing in some way could build awareness of issues related to brain injury in Canada. But what does that do? Like when we have awareness of this is a thing that's going on at a big level, what should we do with that?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's a puzzle that we're also trying to address through our research. So you're right, awareness is number one step. Education campaigns really bring the attention of these issues to the public, to policymakers, to the government, to every person that is at risk or living through the experiences of brain injury associated with drug poisoning. It's very important because then they can make a judgment call around, do I need to see a health practitioner? Do I need to seek specialized care? Do I need to go to a clinic and get checked out? So that's a step one. We also need to change the system. Now, with this awareness, this is a massive call for changes that have to be systemic, not just a person's responsibility, because oftentimes that's impaired, you know, the ability to make that judgment call and say, I am experiencing these difficulties, I need support. That can be affected. So at the levels of the systems, we are having these conversations with policymakers, with government. One of the steps that have really facilitated this had been the Bill C-277. It's a national strategy for the management of brain injury around Canada. So it's bringing attention to all political parties, to all ministers around how important it is to have a cohesive picture across Canada that is not just local. It's not just Victoria, Nanaimo, Vancouver Island, BC. It's not just the West Coast. It's across the nation that would help us to intervene. So that's a big part of awareness. And also, I feel like one of the main outcomes of awareness, development of awareness, is going to be reducing stigma. Having people being able to talk about it, to share their stories, to seek help, to have conversations about it without feeling judged, without feeling afraid of saying, you know, I'm experiencing a lot of those symptoms, and then it could be associated with that event of overdose that I experienced X time ago. A lot of people are in fear of having that conversation, and it can become political, as we have seen in the media, a lot of discussions about harm reductions, and it's being politicized. And that makes it a little bit hard for the public to understand what they should do. But hopefully with awareness, we clarify a little bit the path about what to do.
And the national strategy on brain injury, that is making its way through the House of Commons and through committees. If that ultimately gets adopted, if it gets royal assent, what would you expect that to do?
We are very hopeful that it will go all the way through the end. The first reading, the second reading had passed. It had a very strong unanimous vote across the parliament. So it gives us a lot of hope that there will be change. And what we're hoping is that there will be an increased funding to raise awareness and education across the nation, but also not just that, like the development of guidelines, clinical guidelines that are trauma-informed, that are culturally sensitive, so that they have indigenous lens, that have all kinds of representations on them. Also a sense of having infrastructure in place to make change. So there are lots of isolated associations that work with brain injury societies across BC, across Canada are exemplar in working with these individuals. Community supports really remarkably show how effective they are in helping people recover from brain injury, especially in these cases of hypoxia and anoxia associated with drug poisoning. But they don't have enough resources. They're competing with each other for resources. So if we have a national strategy that is supported with funding, there may be an opportunity to give them more infrastructure to operate. We also hope that with the bill, we'll be creating more bridges to look at individuals where they're at the intersections also that they are experiencing. And by that, I mean, oftentimes what we see is that brain injury doesn't occur in a vacuum. There are a lot of other groups of symptoms that they are experiencing associated with mood disorders, with mental health issues, associated with other kinds of addictions, associated with prior history of brain injury. So when we see them in that integrity, in that compound, we hope to be able to provide them with integrated care so that they are not making endless calls to get into a wait list, to be seen by a psychiatrist around the mental health issues, and 6 months later, doing the same process to be seen on the addictions clinic to get clean up, and then another 6 months, a year later, be seen in the neurology clinic for the brain injury symptoms. We want really an integration, a hub system with a one entry point and system navigators that could help them understand what they need and how to be serviced and can see them in a full picture. Similar to what we have in heart care, like after stroke or in cancer care, where we have a full picture and we're able to provide them with services that wrap around. So that's a big hope with the bill. And also with this bill that raising awareness across the nation, we hope to have more funding agencies across Canada supporting research. So we can look at the outcomes of all those interventions from prevention all the way to care. Long-term care is going to be very important outcome of the bill. Not just this emphasis on the acute stage of identification, diagnosis, recognition, but also the care that follows. That for some patients, it may be a couple of weeks, but for some, it could be a lifelong care that is needed. So there are high hopes, but I think that we are getting there. Like we have this attention from the public and from the politicians that ultimately can help us to make those changes.
This is People First Radio. Today's show is all about brain injury. I've been speaking about the links between brain injury and the toxic drug crisis with Mauricio Garcia Barrera, a neuropsychologist and associate professor at the University of Victoria. Adele Rogers has worked as a volunteer coordinator with the Nanaimo Brain Injury Society. 14 years ago, her son was in a car crash that resulted in a severe brain injury. She says that for people who have experienced one, the transition back into the community after acute care is really tricky. But the example of peers who have been through that process themselves can be a big help.
One of the most impactful pieces moving forward to give us hope was having visitors come. We had two individuals, actually, young men, really close to my son's age, who'd had significant injuries, acquired brain injury, and they were doing really well. And, you know, nothing could have provided that kind of hope like they did, right? And you had alluded to earlier that every injury is so different and so unique. And that's why, you know, rightfully so, the medical professionals, they can't really give you anything to hang on to cling to in terms of hope, because every recovery is so different. Every individual, where they were coming into their injury, the kind of support systems they have after, do they have a good support team once they've left that hospital? Everything is very looked after while you're in the hospital, right? Acute care is amazing, right? And then once you leave the hospital, you're into the community. And what needs to take place for the individual is that ongoing care, that ongoing rehabilitation. And that's really tricky to nail down, because, you know, the emphasis is on that acute care and making sure they survive their injuries, making sure they get off to a good start. And then the rest is up to the individual and the family members. So the transition back into community is really tricky.
June is Brain Injury Awareness Month. I spoke with neuropsychologist Mauricio Garcia Barrera about the links between the toxic drug crisis and brain injury. I was speaking with someone else in preparing this program, and they shared a stat that perhaps 50% of people experiencing homelessness have a brain injury. First of all, is that an accurate stat, and could you help put it in context for me?
Absolutely. Sadly, I have to tell you that yes, it's as accurate as it gets. This stat came from the work of a colleague of ours from UBC, Dr. Jacob Stubbs. He and his team of collaborators, they did a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is just a fancy name for a technique of synthesizing the literature that gives a lot of robustness to findings. Because what a meta-analysis does is that it looks at all the literature published in a particular topic, and then through a very stringent eligibility criteria, they pick the best studies, like the ones that are really meeting the best conditions in their methodology, in their robustness. And then they compare them as a group against each other. So they look at what is the outcome of synthesizing all of these top studies that have been published on the topic. And through that methodological review, they call meta-analysis, they identified that a little over 50%, so it's more close to like 53% of people in those studies experiencing homelessness report clearly having had experiences of brain injury, having had a brain injury in their past. So it's really high. It's a little bit of a chicken and an egg situation here. So what we're seeing is both. Several people that have an undiagnosed, unidentified, and recognized brain injury through several different mechanisms. That could be a fall, could be a car accident, could be a sports-related injuries, could be any kind of other events like veterans of war. And through those, if they were not properly addressed, diagnosed, identified, and processed through care systems, what we're seeing is that some of them end up in a vicious cycle that has as one of the possible outcomes the experience of homelessness. So simple as you lose your job, you lose your relations through all of these changes, the incapacity of holding up your positions, your job, doing your tasks, being aggressive, sometimes having difficulty with self-regulation. So that aggressive behavior can break families apart. And oftentimes they have a hard time having that stability and they end up in the streets. So that's one possible explanation. The other one is that when you are in a vulnerable place in your life that may have increased risk for homelessness, it's very likely that there are other factors that make you have higher risk for more brain injury of all kinds. Could be traumatic brain injury, falls, if you're under any kind of induced state through a substance that you intake, you may be in a higher risk of a fall, of a car accident, having brain injury that way. But also if you are taking drugs, unregulated drugs like opioids, then very likely you could have an overdose. And in those cases, you may have also that kind of hypoxic or anoxic brain injury. So it's all compound. And what we see in our research and looking at Dr. Jacob Stubbs' work is this vicious cycle that can emerge. We see this picture. So when you are in that level of stress, when you have almost nothing at your disposal to cope with that level of stress, oftentimes addiction kicks in and the cycle continues. Further brain injury, more difficulty breaking that vicious cycle. And if you're in the streets, that those risks are very much increased. So to give an example, when you're homeless, the risk of committing suicide is 2 times higher. It's really, really high. So there is a lot of compounding effects there that makes this a very vulnerable population.
That's been a theme that's emerged from everyone I've talked to, is that brain injury is on both sides of the equation of so many things like homelessness, drug use, addiction, it sounds like. So again, I'm brought back to this idea of like, okay, we know that. Now, what do we do with that information?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I also have heard that, you know, we have like the nature and nurture debate around these in the sense of what was first, a brain injury and then addiction, so vice versa. And what we see is that it goes both ways, literally. There are several cases in which there is a higher incidence of traumatic brain injury follow up with history of addictions, substance use and addictions. The research, it's a little bit unclear, but it's because there is all over the place, but in terms of numbers. But what we see is that the risk is higher. That's a given. Like when you have a history of traumatic brain injury or other kinds of brain injury, particularly if there is no system of care in place, your risk of using substances to cope or for other reasons increases. Oftentimes, the mechanism is very clear, it's very direct. So let's say a person that has chronic pain and has access to opioids, if they have vulnerability to addictions, they may increase their amount of intake and so forth. But oftentimes, it's not so clear of a direct line. You know, maybe they find the use of substances to be a mechanism of coping and supporting them in the stress that they are experiencing. So It's a little bit difficult there, but we know for sure that the history of brain injury, particularly if there is no care in place, it's associated with high risk for substance use and addictions. And vice versa, as I started this conversation with you, like when we talk about these experiences of drug poisoning, you know, oftentimes we use the word overdose. We're trying to move away from that code word that's it's very used and useful, but also carries a little bit of this sense of like guilt and knowledge, like there's a dose, and if you overdo it, you have an overdose. But in reality, it doesn't work that way with drug poisoning associated with synthetic opioids, for instance. So when I use the drug poisoning, trying to move away a little bit from that word overdose sometimes. But anyhow, like these events of drug poisoning are associated with the follow-up aftermath of having lack of oxygen in the brain. So brain injury associated with that as well. So I would say when you hear those quotes that brain injury could be in both sides, it's very accurate. There's high risk in both ends. So it's a very worrisome, I would say, situation overall.
You're listening to People First Radio. If you're just tuning in, you might have caught on that we're exploring brain injury on today's program. We're hearing from Mauricio Garcia Barrera, a neuropsychologist and associate professor at the University of Victoria. We're also mixing in perspectives from Adele Rogers. Her son Hayden was in a car accident 14 years ago that led to a severe brain injury. Rogers says that brain injury is an invisible condition, and that can cause challenges for people when they try to access everyday services in the community.
We're trained to look for being under the influence of the people that we're serving. And unfortunately, for a lot of individuals with brain injury, many of their symptoms look like they're under the influence. And for them, it completely changes the dynamics of, you know, their social interactions. And it's primarily because brain injury is often considered the invisible injury. And so the expectations for somebody, for example, coming, you know, walking up to do their business at the bank, right? They look fine. But perhaps when they start to ask for their service, they're maybe slurring, they may be, you know, a little bit off balance. And then it instantly creates this dynamic because the, you know, the person that's supposed to help them isn't quite sure of what they're working with. And I'm going to do a little plug here for the Nanaimo Brain Injury Society to say our clients have a brain injury ID card. It says what their symptoms are. And I can tell you, we get feedback all the time on how positively impactful those cards are. When they have to pull them out, it just totally changes the way they're treated. Unfortunately, it has to sometimes take that card. But the other thing is, a lot of clients will say just having that card that, you know, if they have to pull it out, provides a lot of confidence for them, which is huge when you're trying to re-navigate, you know, your social community and the context and whatnot. So it's really important for people to have something that they can show if they need to let other people know what their situation is. And so then there's more empathy, if you will.
Now back to my conversation with Mauricio Garcia Barrera, who's a lead researcher with the BC Consensus on Brain Injury Project. Last week, there was this big conference, the BC Consensus Day on Brain Injury. The theme this year was exploring the intersections of mental health, addictions, and brain injury with a focus on housing. I am curious both about maybe how housing plays into this and also BC Consensus Day on Brain Injury. Have we reached a consensus in BC on this?
Yeah, thank you for asking this question. And it's a project that I'm very keen on and one of the research leads in the team of the BC Consensus on Brain Injury. So I can tell you a little bit briefly the history of this project to arrive to answering your question. This is an idea that originated with Janelle Brisbiagioni. She is the CEO and founder of the CBG Center for Traumatic Life Losses. And she has been working on our community of brain injury for over 30, 35 years. She's a strong advocate and is actually one of the powerhouses behind Bill C-277. She's the one who really brought it to the attention of the parliament and so forth. You know, along with Alistair MacGregor, the MP that is representing the bill. But she came together with me. She knew that I had this work on sports concussions, on brain injury. And through the conversations on sports concussions, oftentimes we talk about consensus, reaching consensus, creating guidelines to best service those that experience sports concussions. So she wanted to see if we could explore together ways to creating some kind of consensus that will allow us to better define and recognize brain injury in BC, but also identify the barriers, challenges, and opportunities to better service those that are experiencing the intersections of brain injury, mental health, and addictions. So it's a very ambitious project, but we were really lucky. We got funding from the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions and the Vancouver Foundation that was substantial enough to support our meetings. So the main events have been every year since 2022. One was in October in 2022. And the first focus was those that have survived drug poisoning associated with the synthetic opioids and the intersections. The second year was focused on intimate partner violence and brain injury associated with those events. And the third year, as you pointed out, we shifted the focus. Originally, we really wanted to talk about sports concussions, but from the learning of year one and year two of the BC Consensus on Brain Injury, we decided housing is where we really need to focus to close this process and our conversations. So we focus on housing because the first 2 years really pointed out in that direction. And the issue here is that housing is a self-determinant of health. So when you have a house, when you have an address, when you have a home, you have a sense of belonging, a sense of responsibility, a sense of self-determination. You are found in one place. You can get services brought to that place. You can get picked up to be taken to a clinic. There's so many gains associated with having a house. And not just having a roof or a key to a door kind of concept, but a home, you know, the concept of a home that is your responsibility, that cares for you and you care for it. So that makes a significant change. Everyone that is securely housed has a decreased risk of traumatic brain injury, acquired brain injury, mental health issues. And even if they experience those on life, they have a higher probability of getting better, just by the means of having a home that is secure for them. So it's makes a big difference. And that's what we decided to focus the third year on this. So what it looks like, because BC Consensus, you know, it tells us so much, but not so much at the same time, is that we made an effort in gathering all kinds of people that we call stakeholders, community partners, across the community of BC. So we have policymakers, we have researchers, health practitioners, everyone associated with brain injury associations, people with lived and living experiences of brain injury, and all kinds of volunteers like caregivers, people, advocates in the community. We welcome them to these meetings through a private event registration. We have upwards of 106 in the first year, 140 in the second year. Now we're able to house around 160 participants in our last event last week. And what we do is that we have a full day conference of conversations, very little on lecturing. Like we did have Dr. Jacob Stapps, the author of the meta-analysis that we just discussed around homelessness, giving a keynote that was exceptional. But we mostly focus on conversations. We have all these tables, and in every table, there is a representative from each one of those groups, those stakeholders. And we give them, we challenge them with questions around their experiences around brain injury, barriers to get services, opportunities that they see emerging. And they have all these conversations, they create consensus between their tables. We bring them to a board that gets digitalized. And then there's all these apps on their phones with supports. Every table has one or two supports to vote. So we have as an outcome, priorities for research, priorities to identify those barriers, challenges, and opportunities. So it's a great process of what we call community engaged research, participatory action type of community engaged research, really bringing together the voices from every group that we can bring into the room. Every group, you know, representatives from these groups. So it's a fascinating event. We completed the third year. And to answer your question, have we reached consensus? We're getting there. We're starting to see synergies and commonalities between year one, two, and three. The third event was just last week. So we still have a little bit of a long-term task of a few months, gathering all the data collected through that full day of conversations, and then synthesizing these with proper consultation with representatives perspectives of all these groups, and then we'll come up with what we call the BC consensus on brain injury. That hopefully will resonate with the bill C277. It has been foundational to the bill, so we hope to create synergies there and harmonize the objectives so that the outcomes of the bills and the outcome of the BC consensus are aligned, and ultimately to support our community.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. We're focusing on brain injury on today's show. June is Brain Injury Awareness Month. And earlier on, I asked Mauricio Garcia Barrera what we should do with that awareness. You're about to hear what can happen in a situation when people aren't necessarily aware about what brain injury can look like. Throughout the show, we've been hearing from Adele Rogers. Her son Hayden experienced a severe brain injury following a car accident 14 years ago. In this clip, you'll hear about an experience the two of them had while out shopping.
I love the newer term, neurologically diverse, and that just allows for people to be different. And, you know, in the case of an acquired brain injury, not have to be self-conscious because, you know, you have a slur or you have a balance. Unfortunately, just in our own personal world, my son's interaction, in particular in the early days, the different responses in our social context was very disappointing. Again, this idea of an invisible condition, in early days before he was walking again, we would go shopping, you know, and we'd grab one of those carts, you know, the motorized carts, and people would give us, you know, the stink eye, basically, because he looked fine. And we even got, you know, asked at checkout once, you know, why is he using that? It's crushing, right, for someone to have to, if they even choose to, explain why they need a little support or help. And as a result, my son never used it again. So it's real. And that's one example of many that we've had to experience. And, you know, my role as part of his support team was to educate people in that moment, right? I have had to do that many times with the hope that they were able to walk away with, you know, a different sense of, you know, and change their perspective perhaps. But so that public awareness you're talking about is huge. And it's honestly, Joe, not just for people with acquired brain injury, obviously, but just for our communities, just to include people that have something to offer, have something to contribute. They want to, and they just need the support to do that.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Throughout the show, we've been hearing from Mauricio Garcia Barrera, who's a lead researcher with the BC Consensus on Brain Injury Project. I'm going to get you back to that conversation. I also want to talk about the idea of prevention. In preparing to make this episode, someone brought up this analogy of everyone can get on board with the idea of the bicycle helmet as a way to prevent brain injuries when you're on your bicycle for other maybe causes of brain injury, things like intimate partner violence, things like toxic drug poisoning. Is there some kind of equivalent?
That's a great question. And it's a big puzzle that we're trying to also start elucidating and putting together the picture. There is no silver bullet, like one thing that will prevent them all. It's a very complex situation, of course. But what we're seeing is that, as any intervention theory, prevention is the top, is the best intervention. So I think that we need to start there. really having preventive measurements. And prevention starts with education, awareness, what we're doing, having open conversations about these issues that is very relevant, but also are going to be harm reduction efforts, safe supply efforts. It's going to be changing a little bit that we operate even at the moment of resuscitating a person that has lost consciousness because of drug poisoning. So right now we rely on naloxone, and that's fantastic. But what we are really identifying is that the brain needs oxygen. And sometimes there is a little bit of a transition time between getting the naloxone into the system and being able to recuperate fully the breathing function. So rescue breathing is going to be super important. And yes, maybe you are not very capable to do that to a stranger. You may feel a little bit apprehensive. But what if it happens at home or in the classroom while you work? If you are able to provide a rescue breathing to a person that you are a little bit closer to, that can change their outcomes and save their lives and reduce the impact on the brain. So reducing the effect of the respiratory depression. So I feel like prevention measurements like that are going to be super important. And with the education campaigns, I feel like we are going to start, hopefully, as it has happened with the sports concussions, with motor vehicle accidents and the injuries associated with that, starting to change the system. Like in sports concussions, we have learned that it's not just the helmet. There have been changes in policies as well. So like the tackling in hockey or the heading of the ball in practice in soccer. We are making adjustments on what ages we start implementing those kinds of practices. So when we allow it, when we don't, as also preventive measurements. We're going to build some guideline that is going to start pointing in the direction of what else can we do. But for now, I think that prevention is where we are putting our money first.
Mauricio Garcia Barrera is a neuropsychologist and an associate professor at the University of Victoria. Adele Rogers spoke with me about some of the aha moments she's had in the 14 years since her son Hayden experienced a severe brain injury.
A lot of people, as I say, are not the same after they've acquired a brain injury. And, you know, the science just shows you how people are wired and then unwired as a result of a TBI. But something else can take over as well that may never have been there before. Resilience, for one thing, taking something and going with it. So there are moments where, for example, I really miss my son from before, but now what he's been able to accomplish all because of his brain injury has been inspiring, very inspiring. And so it keeps us going when we have our roller coaster rides, our ups and downs, and it is the chronic nature of acquired brain injury that there can be a lot of emotional deregulation. And to not take that personally has been a really aha thing for me, right? It's like this is the nature of brain injury, and we support it, and then we work through it. But the other things is just this idea that the brain can keep going. There can be new stuff, if you will, being created, but it has to be stimulated. It has to be cultured and nurtured, if you will, right? So for me, I learned to challenge my son to be, not just let him play the BI card, we called it the brain injury card, that there is potential. There's strategies, an agenda, sticky notes, and being part of that. And then it becomes our normal, right? Our expectations are what we've created post-injury. So, and just this idea that there's a whole community out there, that was very aha for me. Because prior to that, I had no idea. You hear of concussions, particularly in the sports world, but one of the things, that we're learning now is injuries can come from all different places and we're not even aware of them. Intimate partner violence is, the numbers are increasing all the time. And then, you know, of course, the sports world, they're kind of waking up around that too. So we're just starting to discover all these things that, you know, anecdotally we were aware of, but I'm so grateful for the science that's starting to support. Just something as simple as somebody saying, I can't go back to work full time, and having to fight for, you know, that, you know, whether it's insurance or company policy. So I'm very happy to be part of this growing understanding of what we need to do to support those people with brain injury. And yeah, many, many aha moments.
We're going to keep the conversation going on brain injury on next week's program as well. There's a new research center at Nanaimo's Vancouver Island University that aims to address impacts of trauma, brain injury, and mental health challenges. It's being headed up by Sandy Schultz. I paid him a visit in the center. You'll hear that conversation on next week's show. For now, here's a sneak peek. You shared that maybe there are some issues prevalent in the central, mid, North Island region that the research here is going to focus on. Can you tell me about some of those?
Yeah, so one form of brain injury that is particularly prevalent in this area is due to intimate partner violence or domestic violence. Duncan, for example, the Cowichan region, they have some of the highest incidences of domestic violence in British Columbia. And so we've been fortunate enough to get some funding in collaboration with researchers at UBC, Vancouver and Okanagan campuses, as well as in collaboration with Island Health to do research that hopes to improve our ability to detect people who have sustained a brain injury due to intimate partner violence.
Can you explain what does that look like? What does the research look like and that idea of detecting the brain injury?
Yeah, so it... depending on the context, detecting that brain injury might be very different. So we want to develop methods that are applicable to a number of stakeholders. So, for example, people working at a women's shelter or volunteering at a community organization who might not have medical training, we want to be able to offer them a method such as a screening tool where they might be able to detect that a brain injury has occurred and then, you know, refer that individual on to someone with medical or healthcare experience to provide support for that brain injury. Now, in another setting, such as the emergency department or a forensic nurse examiner that's attending to a intimate partner violence patient or a first responder, here we want to develop methods such as a blood test, where you could, you know, take a drop of blood and rapidly be able to detect objectively whether or not someone's experienced a brain injury. And this early detection is important because then it allows for early interventions and providing support early on, which can help improve long-term outcomes.
So where are we right now when it comes to recognizing something like a brain injury caused by intimate partner violence, or even just awareness that that is a phenomenon going on in the community?
Yeah, so awareness is definitely increasing. But with that said, relatively speaking, awareness is very low. So there have been some, you know, recent public service announcements around it that have been driven by some of our collaborators at SOAR in Kelowna. And so there's definitely been some good first steps taken in increasing general awareness around it. But even in healthcare community and in first responders, oftentimes brain injury isn't considered upon presentation of that patient. And so it's important to understand that, evidence suggests that up to 90% of intimate partner violence survivors have experienced a brain injury. So it's incredibly common, and it could contribute to some of the symptoms and presentations and long-term issues that survivors face.
Yeah, what is the meaning maybe of that awareness? We can talk about there's a need to be more aware. When we have that awareness, what does that allow us to do? What does that change?
Sure, so I think it kind of depends on the perspective you're coming from. If someone in the healthcare profession, if they identify someone presenting to the emergency department who may be confused or may be having some cognitive issues or something along those lines, and they don't know what to attribute that to, it could be due to a brain injury. And if they have sustained a brain injury, then obviously providing them the support and care required for that brain injury, as opposed to if they haven't identified it. From an individual who has experienced intimate partner violence, understanding that there is a good likelihood that you have experienced a brain injury, and that might actually be why you're experiencing some of the problems that you are having. It's something that's been inflicted on you. So I think depending on the perspective, knowing that a brain injury could be at the root of it, has important implications.
And I know that your research here is set to work with the community. Can you tell me about how that kind of develops and what the community's maybe input or role is in the research process?
Yep. From my point of view, the community plays a central role in all elements of the research. So, for example, as a scientist, I can identify an area that I think is important, but if I haven't experienced that myself, there's no way to know if that's actually relevant to the people who have lived experience. And so consulting with people who have experienced traumatic brain injuries, who have experienced intimate partner violence, understanding what their priorities are, what would improve their quality of life, what would improve their care and support, so that we know that it aligns to the research we're undertaking and we're striving to provide solutions to problems that are important to them.
Sandy Schultz is director of the recently announced Center for Trauma and Mental Health Research at Vancouver Island University. You can hear more of that conversation on next week's program. For now, though, we are out of time. You've been listening to People First Radio. A reminder, you can find the show as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. We also have a Facebook page and an X, I guess it's called now, account. I am Joe Pugh. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.